Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of The Jane Austen Podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, and thanks for listening to Bartle's Blatherings, the podcast where Mary Craig and I shine a light, we have a good old chat, and shine a light on the curious, shadowy, and often magical history of the Scottish Borders. Hi, Mary.
Hello, hello.
Are we well?
I'm very well, thank you. How are
good.
You?
Suffering a bit with a cold, but fine. So I'll cough throughout this, no doubt. Was thinking, Mary, of a slight change of plan for today.
Oh, okay.
In two ways. One would be to expand our understanding of borders. So let's cross many borders
today. Okay, we're crossing borders today.
And the second one is this, in my rather laboured intro. Usually, we stick the microphones on, we have a good old natter, and then later on, we decide what we're going to call the episode.
Yes.
I'd like to go with the name of this episode from the get-go.
Okay.
And I'd like to call it, Where to Next, Santa?
Ah, right.
Because okay. I believe Santa to be this figure that has crossed many borders in history.
He has indeed, yes.
And the reason for doing that and suggesting this change of plan, we're entering the winter celebration festival time.
Yes.
Across the world. We're coming towards the end of the old year and we're going into the new year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll avoid calling it Christmas always. But I was watching a quiz program on the TV a couple of days ago. And as we're approaching Christmas, it was a celebrity one.
Of course it was.
And one of the questions was this. It was about the birthplace or the origin of St. Nicholas.
Ah, right.
And of the four celebrities, here were the answers.
Oh, dear.
Two of them went for Germany on the world map.
Really?
And the other two went for two of the countries in Scandinavia. That
really?
Was very interesting. So I thought we might take a wee look at the history, the origin story of St. Nicholas.
Indeed.
Where he started and where he's travelled to over the many, many years.
Yes. I'm surprised that they came up with Germany and Scandinavia. I thought I would have understood if people sort of said the Middle East, maybe,
mm-hmm.
or Greece.
Uh-huh.
But from what I know, he was from southern Turkey.
Yes,
now,
indeed.
He may have had Greek ancestry, but he was southern Turkey, our St. Nicholas was,
yes.
in round about the tail end of the 3rd, beginning of the 4th century.
Yes.
And he was a real actual person. So is Santa Claus, for all those listening. Santa is real.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert, Santa is real. And if you see Santa in the shopping centre or the shopping mall and he doesn't quite look right, that's just his helper Santa.
Have you been a good boy or a bad boy? Interestingly, I'm no slight on celebrities, but
no.
One of the other questions was, well, where do you think the Christmas cracker was invented?
Okay.
And two of them went for Germany again. So we have this very strong German tradition. We can probably... We're going back to Victoria and Albert,
I
should imagine, for many of the great British Christmas, as it were.
Yeah.
But you started by placing us then in Turkey.
Yes, Turkey. Southern Turkey.
I'm going to use English pronunciation for this,
rather
than Turkish pronunciation.
Well, I just spent my whole time saying, what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly that. So I'll do my best at translating as we move along. So St. Nicholas, real person.
Real person, yes.
Tell us more.
3rd to 4th century, And there are various stories about him, but he seems to have been quite a sort of wealthy merchant, but had converted to Christianity and was using his wealth for good. And the main story we have about him is a story where he tries to prevent three young girls being forced into prostitution.
Yes.
Now, the ages of the girls are not exact, but we're hoping they are sort of 13, 14 and above. We're hoping it's not anybody younger than that. But these three girls should have been married, but their father was very poor, couldn't afford a dowry for them. And so they were going to be forced into prostitution. St. Nicholas finds out about this and goes to the house and on three consecutive evenings takes a sack of gold and pours the gold through the bedroom window of the girls, which allows them to have a dowry, which allows them to be married, which allows them to be respectable women, and means that they are not forced into prostitution. So that's a sort of origin story, if you like, for Santa Claus. I think it's a very odd origin story, preventing prostitution.
Yeah.
But that's where the origins come from. But St. Nicholas, he was generous. He gave away money. He would give wealthy gifts to
symbolic
people.
Symbolic generosity and good deeds.
Gift-giving.
Giving the gift doesn't necessarily have to be a physical thing in a tinsel-covered box.
Indeed, yes.
That's the point. Yeah.
But once St. Nicholas or St. Nick or the idea of this moves, the minute he crosses a border, we're into something completely different.
Yeah.
So if you go to Père Noël in France, you put your shoes outside your house on Christmas Eve and Père Noël comes along and if you are good, will put small gifts into the children's shoes. And it's often not actually gifts, it's often sweets, sweetmeats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for children sort of age 12 and under. So I'm sorry, teenagers, you're not getting anything in France. And if you're naughty, you don't get. It's not like today where Santa rewards everybody. You genuinely don't get anything if you're not good. And adults are not really exchanging goods. There is obviously the feasting around the 25th, which is around the summer solstice and having a big, sorry, the winter solstice and having a big feast. But Père Noël is rewarding good children with small gifts and treats. And you don't write a letter and these sorts of things. You're just grateful for what you are given. So that's slightly different from St. Nicholas.
I've been hearing this recently with the German-based language students I'm working with. Their focus often is on the children in the family rather than the adults. They talk about a calm, peaceful time.
Yes.
Stille Nacht.
Yes, and very much
rather
so.
Than this party-popping, joyous, rowdy celebration.
Absolutely, yes.
So there's a difference for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And then when Père Noël crosses the border into the Netherlands, he becomes Sinterklaas.
Yeah.
And Sinterklaas, again, is bringing gifts for children that are good. But Sinterklaas has morphed again, and this time he's coming on a white horse. He has a white horse. And then he has a sidekick. Zwarte Piet.
Oh, yes.
Oh, dear. Black Peter. Now, Black Peter is actually a very new addition to the Sinterklaas tradition. He only appeared round about the middle of the 19th century.
So this is the good and bad being clearly defined then? Is Black Peter a good guy in his own right?
Black Peter is Sinterklaas's helper. He helps give the gifts to the children.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's in most of the images of him, Sinterklaas is on this white horse and Black Peter is sort of walking at his side. But again, it's children that are being rewarded. Good children are being rewarded.
Yeah.
And on that occasion, what you're doing is you're giving gifts on the 6th of December. It's not Christmas Day.
Yeah.
It's on St. Nicholas Eve.
Yes.
So that's where you're giving your gifts there. Then we cross the border into England. And you have Father Christmas. And Father Christmas is actually an amalgam of a whole lot of older traditions.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually going back in our traditions here. And there's shades of the Green Man in there.
Yeah.
Again, it's about gifts, but it's much more about feasting and know me well and the bounty of midwinter and the bounty of harvest that came from the autumn time. And so it's much more about feasting and jolly making and partying and song. And there might be gifts, but it's much more the coming together of parties and celebration and singing and lots of revelry and almost going back to traditions like the Lord of Misrule, which you had in England. Obviously, you know, like fools at the end of Carnival and things like this, where you're king for the day. And you're playing jokes, the jokes you get in Christmas crackers. You wear a crown out of a Christmas cracker because you're the Lord of Misrule, you're the King of Misrule. So that's where that's coming in. The modern day stuff in England of the Christmas tree and all that, we'll get to that. But that's where that's coming from. So that's an older tradition. And then, of course, he crosses another border, goes across the Atlantic and becomes Santa Claus in America. And I'm not going to talk about Coca-Cola.
Let's not do Coca-Cola.
If you wish. But what that morphed into was very much the concentration was in gift-giving. The gift-giving. And this really kicks off actually after the Second World War, because although in Europe we had a different war from America, obviously every country's war is different, but we had had bombs dropping on our heads. We had had... you know, the horrors of the Holocaust. There were camps, people died of starvation and all sorts of things. That did not happen in mainland America. I know Pearl Harbor was bombed, but mainland America was not affected. And at the end of the war, America was very wealthy and America was able to give money to Europe, the Marshall Plan. Now, we did pay it back. It took us a long while.
They were wealthy because you could imagine this tunnel of money leaving us and going to the Americans for payment for the war effort.
Because, of course, their agriculture had not been affected the way agriculture in Europe had. Yeah. Their infrastructure had not been affected. Their transport systems had not been affected. So they were able to pick up on world trade the way Europe couldn't. Mm. So they were wealthier. So it became about bounty and wealth and giving presents and, you know, dad at the head of the household, mum and dad and 2.4 kids and I Love Lucy and all these sorts of things and big cars and big houses with a picket fence. And because, of course, many Jewish people had run from the horrors of the Holocaust, obviously, and had pitched up in America, they were promoting this family ideal because it was the families that they didn't have because their families had died. So they were promoting, you look at the sitcoms and the American programs in the 1950s, it's all about the picket fence and mum and dad and everything's perfect, perfect, perfect. And look at the wondrous gifts we can give our children. You're giving children all of these wonderful, amazing, amazing, amazing things because of what has happened, because of what has happened back. And so Santa Claus, he becomes bigger. Yeah. He gets the big belly. He gets the big white beard. He's a big man with a big booming voice. Yeah. Everything's big. And bountiful and wealth, and that's where that absolute comes in. And that's where Santa Claus becomes Santa Claus.
So in rather in the same way that America shifted and shaped modern Halloween and trick-or-treating, they had a major impact on Christmas as people in the West know it today.
Yes.
Very much.
Yes. Yeah. Although I will mention one little country that sort of bucks the trend. One little country called Scotland, because we didn't do Christmas.
Yeah. It was bad.
It was John Knox banned Christmas, because John Knox said that it was disrespectful to God to throw a party on Jesus' birthday.
Yeah.
And so he banned Christmas. Now, Cromwell comes along and protects it, and he may or may not have banned things as well, but it didn't matter what Cromwell had said. John Knox had said, we didn't have Christmas. So it meant that until 1958, Christmas Day was not a public holiday in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And Boxing Day was not a public holiday until 1974. Now, I am now such an ancient person that I can remember my dad worked Christmas morning. Wow. And that was absolutely standard. Our big celebration was Hogmanay. It wasn't Christmas. I mean, yes, we had a Christmas tree.
Yeah, I'm not even a teenager in those days. And I can only remember Hogmanay.
Yeah,
really.
that was the big celebration. It wasn't Christmas lights in Sucky Hall Street. I don't really remember that growing up. Mm-hmm. So it was quite different. But what we were looking at was we were looking at the winter solstice. We were looking at the turning of the year. We were looking to those older traditions. Yeah. And that's where the Germanic traditions come in of the pagan Christmas tree, because you're bringing greenery into the house of sympathetic magic. Yeah. And it's going back to Yule, because Yule was an old Scots, Scandinavianish name. Yeah. One of the other names for Odin or Wodan, who's the god of wisdom and learning.
Yes.
It's not about
yes.
gift-giving. It's not about gift-giving at mm-hmm. all. It's yes. about the gift of learning
yeah.
and the gift of wisdom. Yeah. And you're going into a new year, and here are wise things to think about, which is where sort of, you know, New Year's resolutions come from. But we sort of bucked the trend with a Sinterklaas or a Père Noël or a Santa Claus, until now, of course, we all just really have Santa Claus.
Yeah, we have he who is Santa. You well done, you've managed to have both a dig at the organised church and demonstrate how they have, in a sense, formed hybrid messages from going back to ancient traditions.
Cleaning
them up for their
yeah,
own.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this before. The Pope, not the current Pope, but the last Pope, but one, I think, is the one who said that you cannot disentangle Christmas from its pagan roots. Mm-hmm. And half the Catholics around the world lost their minds about that. But Christmas, as a Christian, is about the birth of Christ. Everything else, the tree, the lights, the presents, the eating, the Yule log, the wreath, that's all pagan. That's all pagan, which is fine. It's, you know, it's not a problem, but we do have to remember that our Christmas traditions, like all traditions, come from a variety of sources and have all been pushed together, you know, to make it magical for youngsters. That Santa Claus might come down the chimney. Although I did see a lovely cartoon the other day of Santa Claus looking at a house with solar panels and wondering how he was going to manage through those. But he is magical, so he will be there.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Any other parts of the world where Christmas traditions can be said to be distinct from other great British Christmas?
Well, of course, if you look at some of the traditions, if you go up to Iceland, they've got the Yule Lads up there.
Yeah.
And I know Iceland is busy with its volcano at the moment, but they have a black cat who may or may not also be a witch. And she has these, I think it's 13 sons, the Yule Lads, and they are sort of naughty little gnomes, and they will come and create havoc in your house.
Good.
Because they basically, it's a series of increasingly annoying household pranks. So they've got names like the window peeper, or the door rattler, or the spoon licker, and they come in and they'll, you know, you're making a cake and you turn for a minute and they've licked the spoon, and they just increasingly worse and worse and worse. They're mischievous more than malevolent. But it, again, it's to teach you about, it goes back to the wisdom and the learning, you know.
Absolutely.
Be good, be nice to people, and be sharing with people.
Work together and share.
Exactly. If you're making a cake and it's just for your family, but you know that the family next door don't have much money, or they don't have, share the cake with them, because if not, the spoon licker's going to come and lick all your spoons, or the door rattler's going to come and, you know, rattle all your doors if you don't help people out. So that's quite a different tradition.
It reminds me of when I lived in Istanbul, Gültekin and four of his friends, the six of us, sitting around this large metal plate, salver, making chili kofta, which is raw meat, which you are cooking with your hands.
Right.
And the six of us sit for 3 hours.
Yes.
They're talking.
Yes.
We're working together. It's an onerous task.
Yes.
You are kneading this raw meat with onion and various herbs with your hands.
Yes.
Hour upon end.
Yes.
But that very, very communal feeling behind the onerous task is what makes it magical.
It's coming together. It's things like, is it hygge, they call it in the Danish? Is that coming together? It's a ceilidh in Scotland. People often think a ceilidh is dancing. There may be dancing at a ceilidh. A ceilidh means a gathering.
Yeah.
It's a coming together. Yeah. And sometimes you talk, and sometimes you sing, and sometimes you dance, and sometimes you work, and you do all these things communally together. So that even if somebody hasn't got a lot of money, they can join in the conversation.
Yeah.
Or if
somebody
else hasn't had a really good year, they can sing a little song about it. It's that coming together. It's that human contact of coming together and sharing an action like making your meat. And things like that. And I mean, we all remember when your children, one of the best memories you often have is baking a cake with your grandmother.
Yeah.
And basically you're making an absolute mess. But it's the fact that you're with your grandmother doing something, you know, and later on she has to, you know, repair what you've done to the cake or whatever, whatever. It's the coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point of, that's the similarity you see in all of these. It's about family and it's about coming together. The differences in a way are quite slight.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not you give the presents on the 6th or you give the presents on the 25th. Whether you open your presents, it used to be said that if you open your presents in Christmas morning, you're working class. If you open them in the afternoon after the Queen's speech, you're middle class.
Oh, that, no, we were morning.
Most folk were, you know, but these sorts of things.
Yes,
you know, so
yes.
That's the commonalities. And most people, you know, it's an old Christmas, far too commercial these days, but people will still buy for children.
Yeah.
Even when you're broke, you'll think, I need to get something for the bairns. I need to get a wee bit for the weans, or whatever you would say in Scotland.
Going back to my experience of hand knitting the chi kofta with some Turkish friends, after we were finished, long hours of this work, I remember we ate communally together. Mm-hmm. We passed food from one to the other.
Yes.
And Gültekin, a lovely old man, said to me, now, we don't eat it all because we have to take some to the neighbours.
There you are.
There
you
was
see?
Always this
exactly.
gift of giving involved.
Exactly, yes.
Which was very important.
Yes.
And it did open my eyes.
Yes. And also, if you think of most Christmas dinners, most people, if they sit down to an evening meal, whoever, usually mum, but not always, usually the mum will put the plate in front of you and it will have your meat, potatoes and two veg sort of type thing, already plated, and the plate is handed to you. At Christmas dinner, The food is laid out communally on the table. There'll be a big mound of potatoes and a big mound of vegetables. There'll be the turkey or the goose or whatever, and Dad will be carving that.
Yeah.
But it's much more of a communal sharing of food. You're passing the potatoes and, oh, I want some more Brussels sprouts and I want some carrots. It's much more of a sharing of food than usually when you're sitting there with just a plate put in front of you or, who knows, just a TV dinner. You know, so it's, again, it's that sharing of food. And there's always too much food made at Christmas.
Absolutely.
Everybody always makes far too much food at Christmas. And again, that sharing it with a neighbour or keeping it for a friend or keeping it. In some countries, you'll always set an extra plate just in case somebody knocks on the door. And you let them in. Hogmanay in Scotland, if you're having a Hogmanay party in your house and a stranger comes to the door, any other time of the year, you'd be like, who are you? Don't know who you are. Please go away. At Hogmanay, you open the door to strangers. Mm-hmm. And they come in and they have black bun. They have steak pie. They have clootie dumpling or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's that sharing of food with the
community.
It was
a lump of coal, Mary, when I was a wee
lad. A lump of coal, they bring a, because they're bringing warmth to your house, they're bringing heat. So it's the basics. It's food. It's fuel. Mm. It's making sure the children are okay. And it's companionship. And that's what's, that's the similarity in all of these things, whether you're in Scotland with John Knox, whether it's Sinterklaas, or whether it's down in Turkey with St. Nicholas.
Langmuir Lumreek.
Indeed.
Yeah. I remember these tall men coming to the door when I was 5, 6 years old and carrying coal.
Yes. I can remember my uncle, because he was the tallest and he had dark hair, being shoved out the door just before the bells with a lump of coal in his head. And he had to stand outside in the freezing cold in Scotland at midnight waiting for the bells so that he could hammer on the door to get back in again to the warmth. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Fascinating. We started in Turkey.
We did indeed,
with
yes.
this. We've kind of been on a fairly long trip with that rotund, bearded, red-suited one, in a sense. Before we finish this little chat, I'd like to go back to Turkey. Is that okay?
Okay, yes.
And especially the some of the Kurdish regions in the east.
Uh-huh.
You know that I worked with the Turkish government in the 80s, and I spent a lot of time, I lived and worked in southeastern Turkey, and I was working on the English language element of what was the GAP or Anadolu project, and that was financed by the Turkish government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm talking about the Kurdish regions because that's what I experienced. Although, formerly, I was discouraged often by senior government officials. I was discouraged about talking about Kurdistan. But to be fair, most of the people I got to know very well and became friends were Kurdish people.
Okay.
And I think, in a sense, during the time I was there, when people found out, and maybe I was the only native English speaker in a town or village, mm-hmm. when people found out I was from Scotland, I think there was an extra layer of warmth afforded me.
Uh-huh.
And it may be kind of shared experience that was the root of that.
Right.
You know, we in Scotland were at one time the North British.
Oh, that's right. We were wiped off the map.
And many Kurdish people were known as Mountain Turks.
Oh, really? So
there's a kind of shared value and experience there. But I won't dwell on the politics of Eastern Turkey,
mm-hmm.
because that would take me into things like the forced displacement of the Alevi Kurds in Dersim, and a lot of the voluntary migration that took place where people were leaving rural villages to move into the bigger cities
mm-hmm.
to take advantage of work and educational opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned the project I worked on because that project, the Anadolu project, was seeking to address some of these issues.
Right.
but I won't go into that in any more depth because I have many sympathies with the Kurdish people that I met. So I'd like to focus more on the amazing winter festivals that took place in that part of the world.
Okay.
And when I went there, I was naive to that fact. I did not expect in that part of the world to come across such celebrations.
Right.
And what I wanted to do is talk about one in particular, which is Guyane, and see if you can see some similarities in where we are now in the Great British Christmas with what has been going on for 1,900 years in that part of the world. Guyane, in a sense, is a spiritual cleansing or refreshment, an ushering out of the old and a welcoming in of the new. And in essence, now I'm working from memory here, but it's back in the 80s. Each year is ruled by the Sultan of the Turning Time. So we have this idea of the Sultan growing older as the year moves on. And eventually he will pass his temporal kingdom to the next Sultan. But the next Sultan is a bit like our Doctor Who. The next Sultan is just a renewed but distinct version of himself.
That is identical to the English Father Christmas.
Yeah. So that's absolutely this idea identical. Of renewal, renewal. That's going on.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, I've spent Christmas, and I call it Christmas, in the USA, in Mexico, in Belgium, Germany, and other places. But in my naivety, I did not expect to witness such spiritual, almost cosmic celebrations in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
It really opened my eyes.
Yeah.
So if I run through some of the, from my recollection, some of the Guyan-specific activities, see if they remind you of any elements of our Great British Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, we have the Great British Bake Off, the Great British this, that, and it's always the Great British. Prior to the start of Guyane, which runs from mid-December to early January, and in a sense, each village in the Kurdish regions will, each little village will have its own similar but different festival. There are common themes, and they kind of pass it around so everyone can get involved. It usually kicks off with 3 days of fasting. And I think that's very important. They will have 3 days of fasting. Now, here's a good one I remember. A single woman of a household who desires marriage will rise very, very early of a morning. She will go to the village water source. And first of all, she will pray for an early marriage. She will then fill a bucket of water and make her way back to her own house. On that return journey, she will pour the bucket of water down the chimney of perhaps the house of a perceived suitor.
Right.
If she is able to do that without being seen or recognized, her wish will come true.
Oh.
So we have the chimney motif.
Well, yes.
In a sense. I think the most important motif, and this will go back to maybe Christian Armenians, I don't know, is the Trinity motif plays a really important part in the Guyane celebration. And there are three main characters. Now, all of the characters are played by men.
Right.
Who are chosen by a small group of, say, village elders who decide who is assigned the role.
Right.
But the people playing these roles are heavily disguised and heavily costumed and made up. And so they are, in a sense, anonymous. And the three main characters are Carl Guyane, the important fella. His beautiful wife, Fatika, and their protector or bodyguard. So we have this important guy, his beautiful wife, and their protector. And they will, in this heavy disguise, they will walk around the village, visiting families, singing, dancing, gifts will be shared. Simple gifts, usually in the form of bread, food. And then something interesting happens. As they're walking through the village, Fatike, who remember is the Gayan's wife, played by a man, will start flirting with all of the young men she comes across. And the young men will abduct her.
Oh, okay.
And although Khal Gayan and the protector try to stop this happening, she's abducted. And Khal Gayan, the big cheese, he will faint, collapse on the spot.
Oh.
This news eventually goes to the young men who've abducted Fatike. And they return her to her husband. She's distraught when she sees the state of her husband. She weeps for her husband. And then she starts singing laments.
Right.
Not in English. Until Khal Gayan, in a sense, regains consciousness.
Okay.
So that's the renewal, in a sense. Yes. He regains. Yes. And he will take Fatike, his wife, by the hand. And the three will continue their journey through the village. This is an amazing thing to see. And again, gifts are collected and distributed. The essence is always the poorer people. The poor people.
Right, yes.
Are the people given the gifts. One thing about this is each village has a mass of excitable children who are everywhere. But in a sense, they're learning the roles because one day they may be part of this celebration. And that is what's fascinating. Not only gifts, an important thing, and I mention this because I remember in Istanbul being at a meal with some English trainers. And they started throwing bread at each other. And they didn't quite get why the patron of the restaurant was very upset. Because bread is such an important thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You do not
and
throw
it
at each other.
Very important across, especially across the Slavic world. If you're meeting somebody, you offer bread and salt. You know, it's a basic food. You don't throw bread because some people don't have it to eat.
The making and breaking of bread is so important.
It's so important in so many cultures.
And I won't dwell on that. But what I wanted to do is see how you feel about the role of bread because they have special Gayan bread. In Turkey, and here you might see a similarity: the kneading of the dough, which they fill with dried fruit and sultanas, is a very long community exercise.
Yes.
I mentioned the making of chi kofta, for example.
Yeah.
And while that is being kneaded, and this is enough bread for everyone in the village, three little wooden cross-like icons or tokens are placed into the bread.
Yeah.
And when the baked bread is shared and eaten together, whoever finds one of these three tokens has, let's call it, significance bestowed upon them.
Yes.
And that's fascinating for me.
And that's very similar to Christmas cake, because, of course, Christmas cake is full of dried fruits. And I don't know if people do it now, but it used to be you would put
Threepenny bits
and sixpences inside.
I remember
and
that.
And two or three would go inside the cake mix. You would mix. I mean, the cake was made for forever. This cake was force-fed sherry and all sorts of things, whether I liked it or not, you know. It was a big communal thing to mix the fruit. It was communal making that bread and or rather than, sorry, the bread, the cake. The other thing was clouty dumpling, and again, tokens would be put in them, and if you got them, that was your luck for the year.
Exactly that. And I remember hurting my teeth on a thorny bit.
It was great, it was lucky, and again, it's fruits, it's dried fruits, it's raisins and sultanas and currants. So you're bringing that sweetness into either a bread or a pudding or a cake.
Yeah.
Yeah, very similar there.
It's interesting the overlap, but the distinct activity that goes on. If I can give you just quickly what the three icon tokens, if you like, represent. First of all, and you mentioned something about Black Peter, as it were. You have the wealth cross. And whoever finds that will have luck all year round.
Yep.
That's the basic. So these are villagers, usually.
Yeah.
If they throw that icon, that token, into a field, a rich harvest is guaranteed in the coming year.
Yep.
However, placed into a stable, for example, if they are herders, it will ensure the birth of many female animals, bringing wealth at market. Yeah. So we have the fertility symbol. The most interesting of these, and you mentioned something earlier, is what I would call the naivety cross. And the finder of this becomes the laughing stock of the village celebration.
Oh, they become the fool. Ah.
For the duration of the festival.
Of the festival period, they are the fool. Right.
Yeah. And maybe the lesson is character building through being made fun of. But that reminded me of Holland and what you were saying there.
Yeah, but I mean, you're bringing joy to other people by acting the fool.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the third token?
And that's the wisdom.
That's interesting.
That's the jackpot. That brings wisdom, prudence, and sagacity. So you this is the big one.
Again, the wisdom of Odin. Now, in the traditions over here, it's usually three tokens that represent health, wealth, and happiness.
Yeah.
So there are some similarities there. Wealth, if you've got lots of, you know, crops or lots of cattle to sell at market. Yep. Happiness, you're making people happy by acting the fool. And health, good luck for the year. So very similar. Very similar, but in their own ways very different.
I like the, personally, I like the idea of the laughing stock, the naivety cross, because it always, you know, in Glasgow, in the square, you have, Wellington always has his cone on his head.
And, he does indeed, quite right.
The kind of lesson is, we laugh at ourselves before we laugh at anybody else.
Yes.
It's something that is not true in every culture.
Mm-hmm.
But here we find it in an ancient part of Turkey, this idea of being the laughing stock.
I do think you find that in, and this is, of course, me with my sweeping generalizations, smaller countries or ethnic groups within larger countries.
Absolutely that. Yeah.
Because If you're the English in the British Empire, you have to be all in charge and snooty and Whereas if you're the Scots or the Welsh or the Irish, you're a bit of a laugh about it. If you're Turkish, you're in charge. Whereas if you're Kurdish, you think, oh, well, I don't, you know. I'm not, you're not giving me any respect, so I can either sit here and be depressed about it or I can have a bit of a laugh and a joke. So you'll often get humour, I think, in smaller communities.
I think you're absolutely right. I avoided the politics of the region because there have been uprisings against the Turkey and so on and so forth. But it's also this idea of a inward-looking, passive resistance, you know, through symbolism. And I think that's equally important.
Through laughs and jokes,
Any thoughts on similarities?
You're three figures, and of course you've got the three wise men. And then you've got Mary and Joseph and the donkey certainly travelling to Jerusalem. I saw a lovely cartoon the other day of Mary and Joseph on the donkey. And Mary is saying to Joseph, well, it's the holiday season, so have you booked ahead? And he said, well, no, not quite, but I've got some mates coming round and with some gifts. And he said, well, I hope some of them are bringing painkillers. but yes, you're three figure because three is, in pagan culture, three is a very significant number because three is a stable number. Three is a, you know, the triangle is a stable thing. So three is quite a, and your three tokens and your health, wealth and happiness, your three bits of coinage in British baking or whatever. So yeah, three is
I'm
quite,
not qualified psychiatrist, but I think the human brain just likes things in threes and identifies.
Yeah.
Get Brexit
because if you have two things, then they can end up in a sort of binary opposition to each other, black and white. Whereas if you have grey in there, it's much more nuanced. It's much more believable. You can move between three objects more easily than you can between two because two, by their very nature, oppose each other. Whereas three are opposite. I do think it's interesting that when the first Christians went up to convert the Germanic tribes who were polytheistic, and they said to the Germanic tribes, well, now there's only one true God. the Germanic tribe said, well, okay, there's only one good God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. Yeah. At which point the Germans said, but that's three.
Exactly.
And the first Christian said, no, no, it's one. God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. And I went, well, that's three. And eventually they actually stopped telling them about God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. And they just said there's one true God for quite a long time until they got them into the idea of that and then tried to explain the Trinity, which just confuses everybody.
So, yeah,
the
Trinity is baked in to our various cultural Christmas cakes, in a sense, and our celebrations,
if you look into pre-Christianity, if you look into pagan, if you look into Woden and Odin and all the different, especially the Norse gods and the Germanic gods, they come in threes. If you look at the fairy rings up north in Scotland, in Glenshee and places like that, Shivahalan and Shahalian, it's in threes. Mm-hmm. The Kaliags are in threes. Mm-hmm. Three is that number where the Yule lads come in threes. There are 13 of them, they interchange all the time, but they come in threes.
Yeah.
There are three wise men. I saw three ships sailing in. So three is that special number.
We three kings of Orient are.
Yes.
One in a taxi, one in a car.
Okay, if you say so.
It's just the stuff I learned at school when I was a wee boy.
Yes, indeed.
Mary, thank you. Before we finish, I would like to give a special mention to Mansur, whose family come from the Kurdish part. Is it Dersim? The Dersim region, Tunjeli province.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a lot of background information. He now lives in Germany, but his family originate from that part of the world.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
He was able to teach me. I meant to be teaching him, but he was able to teach me quite a lot about things I witnessed but didn't quite understand at the time. And also thank you for the journey that we took with Santa Claus.
On his border crossings.
And we didn't fall into the Coca-Cola red suit trap.
We did not do so.
Mary, thank you very much.
Indeed. Well, bye for now. And
bye for now.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.